In Matthew chapter 2, continuing from where we were last week. Last Sunday we covered the visit of the wise men, the magi, and some important things that we could learn from their coming to Christ. Today we're looking in Matthew chapter 2 in verses 16 through 18 specifically. What we covered last week had a direct bearing about what we'll cover today. When the wise men didn't return to Jerusalem, for we see in verse 12 that they were warned by God not to return to Herod. We find that they returned to their own country by another way. Then we find at the same time that Joseph is warned in verse 13 that Herod is going to seek to kill the child. And so Joseph flees to Egypt. Joseph responded immediately, and no doubt was within the borders of that country when Herod's decree was set in motion. And this morning what I would attempt to do is to examine two aspects of these verses that we'll look at. And one is the decree that Herod gives. And then secondly, the prophecy that it fulfilled. So we have the decree and the prophecy, and then I will hopefully try to follow this up with some lessons that this event can teach us. So, the first thing I want to look at is the decree. You see it in verse 16. When Herod saw that he had been tricked by the Magi, he became very enraged and sent and slew all the male children who were in Bethlehem and all its vicinity, from 2 years old and under, according to the time which he had determined from the Magi. Herod is enraged. What brought it about? Well, Herod believes that he's been tricked. Those words that we see in the beginning of verse 16 are words that we would interpret that from Herod's viewpoint, it appeared that he had been tricked. We pointed out last week that Herod was a man who had accomplished quite a bit, especially in the area of building things, but he was a man of many flaws, a man of many problems. Same time, he was a proud man, but he was also a paranoid man. A paranoid man who would have his own children, two of his own sons, executed, and his own wife executed because he imagined that they were plotting against him. Herod was already disturbed when the wise men came to Jerusalem. The thing that set him off, because these wise men came to do honor to a king, and he wasn't a king that they came to do honor to. In fact, theoretically, Herod was not a king, but a territorial governor, still under the Roman emperor. And he had his authority and all as long as the Roman emperor was happy with him. But the Roman emperors gave such governors so much power and authority that it's easily believed that they were referred to as kings. So these wise men show up with their royal treasures. They talk of a star that led them to this city. And it set Herod's fear in motion. And when the wise men did not return after he had told them to return, he felt as if he had been tricked. See, one interesting thing about people is people have a tendency to feel and think that other people think just like them. So when the wise men didn't show up, Herod said, "Aha, see? They tricked me. Well, why did Herod send the wise men to Bethlehem in the first place? Remember those words that he said to the wise men? Go, find the child. Let me know where he is. Why? Well, that I, myself, can go and worship him. Now, Herod was trying to trick the wise men because he didn't want to go and worship the child. He wanted to find out where the child was so he could have his rival killed. If this is such a big deal and he's already been proclaimed king of the Jews, I can't have this. So people tend to think that others think just like them if they're in that kind of mindset. Herod thought, since he was one who tried to trick the wise men, the wise men in turn had tried to trick him. And so the wise men, when they didn't return, he became enraged. He feels like he's been tricked. But did the Magi really trick him? Did the wise men really trick him? Or was there something else involved? Well, there was something else involved. They were following a different king, not him. But you can see in the person of Herod that when pride and paranoia join together, the results can be disastrous. We see there in verse 16, when he saw that he felt that he had been tricked, what happened? He became very enraged, exceedingly wroth. Another way it's put. And that word very, or exceedingly, means beyond measure. So he became angry beyond measure. Have you ever seen anybody in a rage such as that? It didn't make any sense in what they were doing. They were just absolutely overcome by rage. It's when people tend to look their best, isn't it? Enraged beyond measure. And in the heat of this rage, you can see this pride kicking in, and the idea was this: how dare they do that to me? Proud men are very quick, or should I say proud people, are quick to imagine insults. Now, not only would the pride, the paranoia kicks in. He must kill this child before this child can claim his crown. No doubt the wise men had given him the idea that it was fairly recently that they had seen the star. It's not like they saw the star, whatever it was, appearing in the sky and said, let's study on this for a few months. Let's see if we can get some government funding and see what kind of research we can do on this that we see in the sky. Remember at the time that they're looking at this thing, a telescope's not been invented. The only thing they can do is look with the naked eye in the sky and see and judge. By that, of course, now you would think what the sky that they looked at was a bit different than the sky that we look at today. One of the things that made it real clear was the fact that all around where they lived, there weren't these security lights at night. So when the sun went down, it became black, dark. And certainly you could study the stars probably a whole lot easier in a situation like that. But this was a star that not only appeared at night, but led them during the day as well. And this kind of thing, they immediately seized upon and followed it. So to my estimation, as best as I can figure it, and you can take it or leave it, I don't think there's been 6 months that have transpired between the birth of Christ and this particular period of time that we're looking at today. And you can see the twisted mind of Herod at work. He had ascertained the time from the wise men that they saw this star, and he began to do some figuring. He thought, well, you know what? If it's been within a year, I guess I could go ahead and destroy all those who are a year and under. But what if those wise men were misleading me? They've already tried to fool me one time. What if they were misleading me that time too? I'm not going to take any chances. If I make it 2 years and younger, I'll definitely get him. You notice he didn't say just get the 2-year-olds. But the decree went for all who were 2-year-old and under. That way he figured he'd take all chance out of it. He'd definitely get that one who was his rival by adopting that kind of plan. That's what his twisted mind had come up with. Now Bethlehem is approximately 5 miles away. And no doubt he had sent his own men out to check what was happening. And his men more than likely returned to him and said, the wise men are gone, and the child is too. Again, thinking as Herod probably did, oh, no doubt they've hidden this child in the village of Bethlehem or around about that village somewhere. He issues this cruel order. And he feels like if he does it right now, he'll most surely get that child. Now, one thing, too, to consider is a child would be considered 2 years old as soon as he entered his second year. They mark birthdays exactly the same way that we do now. So if a child was 13 months old, it'd be considered a 2-year-old, not a 1-year-old. How many children were killed on that night? How many boys were destroyed? Well, some have tried to overplay this thing. Because there's one particular group that even has it marked on their ecclesiastical calendar, the murder of the innocents is the title of the day that they observe, the Sunday that they observe, the holy day. And these people would have us to think that on that night, 14,000 little boys were killed. 14,000. Well, that's quite a number, isn't it? A scary number. But I don't think at that point in time that you could have found 14,000 people in and around Bethlehem. The number, more than likely, if we try to figure on what probable population statistics were, then the number was really more like 15 to 20. Now that's a long jump down from 14,000, but in reality, the number was from 15 to 20, more than likely, who were killed. Now that lower number is not to downplay what had taken place, because if it had been your child who was killed that night, it wouldn't matter how many were told. But the real sad part about this is when we look at it is it was so very unnecessary. And then secondly, Herod fell under the same misunderstanding that so many in Christ's time would fall under, and so many even today have fallen under. Herod fell under the misunderstanding of thinking, this man is going to set up an earthly kingdom right here. That's what he was afraid of, and that's why he had Christ, or tried to destroy Christ. He's a threat to set up an earthly kingdom right here and remove my kingdom from me. He was totally mistaken. Christ never came to do that. But in his mind, that's what Christ came for. And this is the same misinterpretation and misunderstanding that has plagued so many for so many years. The Jews, especially the Jewish leaders, sought to have Christ killed. Why? Because they feared that He was going to take their place and their authority. Others joined up with them because they became disappointed when they found out that Jesus wasn't going to set up an earthly kingdom at that time. And there are still many today. Many today that fall under the same misconception that Jesus is going to set up some kind of earthly kingdom. When He was with us, He said, "My kingdom is not of this world." He told that to Pilate even. It didn't make any difference. Well, this is the decree that was set out. And of course, it wouldn't be the last time that somebody would try to kill Christ because they were afraid for their own power and authority. But the next thing we see is the prophecy. The prophecy that's given that was fulfilled, and this is the third time that we see this kind of idea taking place, and just in those verses that I read in your hearing earlier today. There are three times it's mentioned that prophecy was fulfilled. This is the second time. Then what had been spoken through Jeremiah, the prophet, was fulfilled. Jeremiah 31:15 basically is what is being spoken of. A voice was heard in Ramah, weeping in great mourning. Rachel weeping for her children, and she refused to be comforted because they were no more. Now this prophecy from Jeremiah was literally fulfilled during the reign of Nebuchadnezzar and the victory that he had over Israel and the dispersion of those who were around Jerusalem and the surrounding parts. But here it's applied again. And how do we understand it? Well, very quickly, to just give a little background, Rachel was the mother of Benjamin. She died giving birth to him. It was the child that she wanted more and above all the others. Benjamin would be the father of a tribe. And this tribe of Benjamin would inherit the land that was around Bethlehem and around Jerusalem. And so the tribe of Benjamin originally had the land that had Bethlehem in its borders. So these children, these boys who were killed on that night, many of them were from the tribe and stock of Benjamin. Now again, this is somewhat symbolically fulfilled when we look at the term Ramah. A voice was heard in Ramah. We're not going to look specifically for a geographical spot because the word Ramah means a high hill or a high place. It means that the cries that went out loud, like they were shouted out from a high hill. But why the great weeping? Well, look at it and say, well, yeah, look at children have been killed. Isn't that a course in a source for great weeping? Would make sense, wouldn't it? Well, yeah. But there's also something else that's going on at this time. Not only was it the thought that perhaps a generation of a family would be destroyed, but there's also the fear that in the midst of this, the Messiah was killed as well. Now, how do you make that kind of jump? Well, it's easy. First, you had the shepherds that came, and then they went all around talking about what they had seen. Then you have the visit of the wise men, and of course, that went all around the city. So everybody knew that something very spectacular had taken place, and that the Messiah, not everybody, but a good number of people would have figured that perhaps this is the time, because they were expecting this, that the Messiah would be born. And if that's the case, and all these little boys were being killed, the Messiah, their hope, had to be among them. So there was great weeping. But in both cases where the word is applied, the would-be destroyer fails, and blessings still remain for God's people. Blessings still remain for God's people when they were brought into captivity under Nebuchadnezzar. Blessings still remain for God's people after this murder of the young boys, because he didn't get the Messiah. Just as a little side note too, the tomb of Rachel is near the village of Bethlehem. Now there's one thing when I look at this that sticks out in my mind. Herod comes up with this terrible, disgusting decree to kill all these little boys. And the thing that's really troublesome is it gets carried out. It gets carried out immediately. And we hear nothing of anybody trying to resist the decree. That means Herod's men readily took what Herod decreed and carried it out. What kind of men would be so willing to carry out such a disgusting decree? It had to be those soldiers of his who were Roman soldiers who were not Jews and looked at them as some kind of lower life form that were able to carry out such a disgusting decree. It seems wicked hands never seem at a loss for wicked tools. And with Herod, a man who would kill his own children, his own sons, would not seem to have any trouble killing the sons of others. Well, when I look at this, this bloody incident, are there things that we can learn from it? There will always be unanswered questions. We'll never know for sure how many children actually were killed that particular time. Some make a big point out of this and say, you know, well, Josephus, the historian, doesn't write this incident down. Well, Herod had so many disgusting acts during his time, and as he got older, it just got worse and worse and worse, that the killing of 15 or 20 children was not going to make a big headline. But what are some things that we can learn from this? Well, one thing is the title of this event. It has been called by some the slaughter or murder of the innocent. But let's be clear. Little children, as cute as they are, and babies, as sweet as they seem, are not innocent. children are sinners from the point of conception. And diseases and death of little children prove original sin exists. But someone might ask, what happened to these children? What became of these children? Oh yeah, they were killed, but, you know, what happened after they were killed? Are they all in heaven now? Is there any way that we can look at this and say, well, yeah, it was a terrible event, but these children are all right? It's a hard topic. It doesn't say anything specifically in here that would say, and the children went to be with the Lord. And so we have to ask a series of questions in order to discern the probable end. Why were these children killed? Is the first question we have to answer. Why were they killed? Well, they were killed because Herod got angry. He felt threatened. But who did he feel threatened by? He felt threatened by Christ. So for whose sake were these children killed? They were killed for the sake of Christ. In essence, we might be able to say that these children were among the first martyrs in the New Testament church area. And I don't think that's too much of a stretch. The reason they were killed was because Christ had come. And so therefore, I have no trouble in saying that they shed their blood for Him who would soon shed their blood, His blood for them. And I would think that if this is the case, and you go to those children now with their Lord and ask them about the incident, they would consider it an honor that the tyrant's rage was taken out on them and not their Lord. It's a hideous event. It's a disgusting event. But I cannot imagine that since this blood was shed because of Christ, it working out any other way. Well, then another question that somebody might ask is, well, then why didn't God intervene? But God did intervene. He intervened with Joseph to tell them to take the child to Egypt. He intervened with the wise men to tell them to go a different way. But why didn't God just destroy Herod and destroy the men who carried out His decree? Why didn't He just go ahead and do that? The preservation of Jesus from the destruction that took place can be seen as a picture of God's care of His children in their greatest danger. And in their greatest danger, God does not often, though He easily could, He could easily cut off our persecutors, our troublers, those who come up against us, those who threaten us. He could easily do that. But He didn't. Instead, He provided a hiding place. And He preserves His church through Christ from being swept away even when the enemy came in like a flood. Another thing that we see in this, that right from the very beginning, the enemy has been trying to destroy Christ and his church. Do you know what happened in the garden that we talked about a few weeks back? That very first effort by Satan when he caused our first parents to fall was an attempt to destroy Christ and his church. I think he thought literally what God had said. You eat of the fruit, you will die. If I get them to die, they can't have any children. And if they can't have any children, there will never be a Messiah. We see before Christ can even begin his earthly ministry, there's an attempt to kill him. We see when Christ, just before he begins his earthly ministry, there's an attempt by the devil to derail his whole plan. Through the series of temptations that he offers him. There's always, always going to be that kind of friction. Even to today, so much of, we have to use these terms, radical Islam. So much of Islam would be delighted if Christianity were wiped off the face of the earth. Notice lastly a couple of different things. Verse 19. But Herod died. And then verse 20. Those who sought the child's life are dead. No matter how hard Herod tried, he couldn't keep his rule, his kingdom. Herod died. But also, it's interesting, isn't it, there in verse 20? Those who sought the child's life are dead as well. And so to try to bring this into focus of what I said earlier, I'm going to close with this question. If you were to stand before God today, which one would you rather stand before God as? As one of Herod's men who carried out the decree? Or would you rather stand before God as one of the babies that were killed by Herod's decree? I don't think it's much of a choice, is it? I'd much rather stand before God as someone who was killed because Christ was on the earth than ever stand before Him as one who tried to annihilate His church from ever coming into being, before it could come into being. And that gives somewhat of a bit of a comfort as we look at this. God in His great wisdom works all things out. Can I tell you 100% sure these children went on to be with their Lord? No, I can't. But I can tell you that in that great judgment, it seems like it would be a whole lot better to be able to say, I was killed because of Christ, than to say, I killed because of Christ. Let's stand together in prayer.